easy to listen to me for one more week. So we're going to be, as it tends to be when you see my face on this, we tend to be based a little bit more around nutrition this evening. So we're going to go through something that is probably one of the most important factors when we talk about health and longevity, and it tends to be massively neglected in the general population, right? So when you guys come on board and your coach is telling you to do your cardio, he's doing it for a particular reason, right? And I'll show you why. Oh, Sarah, can you just let me host or let me share, please? Thank you.
Just made you co-host.
Thank you. Once I get this up, we'll be ready to go. So this one won't be as long as last week for anybody who was on. So we'll have loads of time at the end if anybody wants to ask questions. We'll lead into, we'll put in a couple of client case studies that I've gone through in terms of some of Gav's clients as well, with some a little bit more in detailed functional testing that we did to try and solve problems that those particular clients had. And but we'll get through metabolic flexibility first. So metabolic flexibility is one of these things that sounds quite sexy and when people talk about it, but it's a really, really basic concept. But it is very, very important, not just for general health, but for longevity. And well-being is a massive factor that's involved with metabolic flexibility. And in its most simple definition, this is the thing about it. It's all it is the ability to be able to shift from one fuel source to another. That's all it is. So it's the ability to shift from using glucose or carbohydrates to fats for fuel. That's all. But when this goes wrong, we see so many problems accumulate within clients. So whether that's fatigue, whether that's issues with cognition, whether it is cardiovascular issues, whether it's diabetes, all the diseases of Western civilization seem to have some sort of component with metabolic flexibility, or as you'll see with what's called our mitochondria. Some of you might remember this from like high school biology, right? They used to talk about the mitochondria as like the powerhouse of the cell. It's that thing within the cell that actually creates energy. And that's what we're going to go through today. We'll touch on what it actually is briefly. We'll talk about where it can go wrong. And then we'll talk about some of the solutions that you guys can use in order to fix it. So I'll keep this part brief, I promise. So the biochemistry stuff, we're going to try and keep it really quick, really efficient, so that we can just get on and talk about the real cool stuff and the stuff that you guys can do to change it. We'll talk about how we lose it. We'll talk about nutritional solutions, lifestyle considerations, and then I'll touch a little bit on the training side of things. We'll talk mostly about the aerobic work that you guys have to suffer through. So whether that's sitting on a bike for 60 minutes, whatever it is, but we'll touch on the different modalities that we can use, right? Yeah, I know. People look at these things and they get really panicky. I don't want it to be that way for you. I want you to think, right? I just want you to be able to understand when I say left-hand side dominant versus right-hand side dominant, what that actually means and where all this big mess tends to go wrong for people. So when you look, it's all this is a cell, right? And these are the two substrates that we use to create energy. Because you have to think of energy production like we always think we eat food, we create energy, right? It doesn't really work that way. It's like going into a casino. You can't use money to play. You have to go and trade money and get chips and then use those chips to play. And it's really the same way with the mitochondria or in energy production. You take glucose, you take fatty acids, and you break them down, you put them through these pathways, and you create ATP at the end of it. So you see that at the very end. That's what we use to fuel our systems throughout the day. So like when you look at the left-hand side quickly, you see glucose being one of the major one out here. And when that comes into the cell, don't worry about all these bits that it tends to do on the way down. But at the very end, it turns into something called pyruvate. Now, let's get through this quickly. You've got two destinations for this. It can either turn into lactate. So lactate's that stuff that we feel when our muscles start to burn. It's part of it anyway. But that tends to happen without the presence of oxygen. Okay, so think about that. When you're working extremely hard in the gym, it tends to be without the presence of oxygen. High intensity work that makes muscles burn and makes you out of breath. And that's great when you are considering training, right? You don't want to be using that pathway when you are at rest. You want to be able to flip and use fatty acids, because this part of it, anaerobic glycolysis, it's called, only produces two of the energy substrates that you want. That's it, right? Whereas if you can get carbohydrates into the cell, it produces 32. And then if we look on the other side, we're nearly there, with fatty acids, one long chain fatty acid produces about 132. So a massive amount more energy. And this is what we want to use at rest. And all metabolic flexibility is to be able to flip from this to that. What you see in large parts of the population, those of you who are fatigued, those of you who can't make it past lunchtime without nodding off or needing food, or who get hangry, agitated, all these things, that's an inability to flip from one fuel source to another. So when glucose runs out or you're fasted, we have to be able to flip. Now, everyone talks about the calorie model, right? I won't go through all these in detail. I'll bore you all to death. When people talk about the calorie model, yes, look, no one can deny that calories play a role. But when, actually, I'll just go through that real quick. Through this whole process, you need to understand that it is so nutrient dependent. So when your coach or we're advising, like, you know, take this supplement, take this, like, there's reasoning behind it, because throughout this whole process, you need basically all the B vitamins, like lipoic acid, iron, copper, CoQ10, carnitine, all these things that you hear about in the health sphere, but they all seem to play a role here in energy production. So let's get away from the science of it. Where does all this go wrong for you guys? First and foremost, you can't avoid the point. Overfeeding, type 2 diabetes, insulin resistance, all these words that you hear will cause this problem. Because when you throw loads of those substrates, loads of those food sources, glucose, fatty acids, when you throw a lot of them at the cell at one time, what tends to occur is you get what's called metabolic gridlock. So the cell basically says, I don't want any more substrates in here. I have too much. It's causing all this, because in the production of energy, we actually produce a little bit of damage, right? And our body's normally able to deal with that quite well when it's working efficiently. But what tends to happen with loads of people is this: when you throw loads of food at it over and over again, this metabolic gridlock accumulates and the cell just doesn't want anything else in it. So like first and foremost, if you've got, or if you know people that have issues with excess visceral fat, you know, that fat, that protruding fat that men tend to get, you can't necessarily grab it, but your belly sticks out. All right. That's a sign of metabolic, or it can be one of the components of metabolic flexibility. Okay, so overfeeding, type 2 diabetes is a huge one. This is one, I'm not going to go into too much detail on the immune system, man, because it is extremely complex. I struggle to understand it myself, never mind teaching it to you guys. But when we get an accumulation of visceral fat, or we've got dysbiotic guts, where we've got poor digestion, where we've got silent infections, COVID did this really, really well, unfortunately. What tends to happen to our system is we have to understand our immune system only runs from that left-hand side dominant equation. So it only uses glucose. and shifts everything away from that other side where we can produce loads of energy, because it uses that side to proliferate and grow and increase cholesterol and do these all of those nasty things that we don't want it to do. We want it to be, we want it to efficiently produce energy for us so that we can feel good throughout the day. And like some of the symptoms that you tend to see with people who have metabolic inflexibility is that inability to be able to make it from one meal to the next without falling apart. It's chronic, sporadic fatigue throughout the day. Like that's the kind of associations that we see with metabolic flexibility. And this one is the, like, we always come back to this, right? On every single one of the calls, but stress and cortisol play a big part here. Like acutely, stress is brilliant. And that's the way it should be. We should get stressed from stressful scenarios and then we should recover from them, all right, and go back to normal. But when we get stressed over and over from the same triggers that we don't resolve, it just, it creates that metabolic gridlock that we spoke about a little bit earlier. So you find people that are hyper-stressed over and over again, they never truly recover. And all these substrates just accumulate over time and cause, and this is why like it's one of the precursors to type 2 diabetes and all the diseases of Western civilization, right? So if you think about the diseases, the predominant ones of Western civilization, we always think type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's, and cancer. They all have a stress component to them, okay? So it has to be taken into consideration. This was one of the more fascinating ones, right? Like for you guys, anyone on this call who has any problems digestively, so whether that's bloating, distension, gas, diarrhea, constipation, acid reflux, we see in a lot of men now. Well, it depends if you find fascinating. I found it fascinating that the mitochondria technically, so this is where the energy is produced, actually is or was a bacteria initially. So the bacteria within our gut have this weird crosstalk that they do. So when we have a really bad buildup of bad bacteria in the gut, it speaks and blocks off different parts of the mitochondria. And one of Gav's clients was an excellent example of this. He came in and one of the funny things that these things tend to do is they tend to make us chronically fatigued, but they don't let us sleep. So this particular client came in and he was in really, really good shape, ate really, really well, predominantly based around a carnivore diet, but he had bad digestive issues and he could not sleep. And he sent me on his blood panel. The blood panel looked great. I was like, this is a healthy guy. I don't know what's wrong with him. He went and he got a stool test because digestive problems were one of his problems, was one of his issues. And he had a massive overproduction of hydrogen sulfide within his gut. And through nutritional protocols and supplemental approaches, he's now sleeping straight through with a sleep score of above 90. And this is one of the more individualized approaches that we tend to have to look at with certain people, because although his dietary approach looked really good and he visibly looked great, there was a part within him that, because of this overproduction of hydrogen sulfide within his gut, would not allow him to sleep. And it had him chronically fatigued and almost in a depressed state. So it shows that although the high protein diets that we tend to put people on, possibly the lower carbs, average fats, whatever it is, there's an individualized process to a lot of this with certain conditions. And this was definitely one of them. And that was one of the real success stories that we've seen recently with our use of like functional testing, right? And circadian rhythms is a big one. So circadian rhythms is, we should be like, obviously, wakeful during the day, and then melatonin should increase at night. So your circadian rhythm is basically an internal clock that tells you when you should be awake and when you should be asleep. It's based off light as well, but we have this internal clock that seems to regulate it for us. And a really good way of putting this is, like, there was a small study done on a certain amount of people, right? Healthy men, no metabolic problems. They left them on the same calories and they just flipped them. So they took their lives, they made them eat, instead of eating during the day and sleeping at night, they flipped it. So they kept them awake at night, made them eat the same calories and let them sleep during the day. And don't quote me on this, but I'm sure within about 3 weeks, these guys were pre-diabetic. And side note anecdote on something like this, like to see how important circadian rhythm and when you eat is, because I know like you'll hear your coach say, don't eat 3 hours before bed, eat at regular intervals, eat around about the same time every day as much as you can. I remember being at some of the guys on the call, some of the coaches on this might know this gentleman, Luke Lehman, was a presenter that in our field in nutrition, who was quite famous, still is quite famous. And I remember being at one of his seminars and there was a lady there and she put her hand up. He was talking about circadian rhythms and night shifts and all these kind of things. And she put up her hand and she said, oh, my husband's a copper or a policeman. And what should I do for him? And his answer was, get life insurance. Now, that's not necessarily the advice that I want to give, but you need to understand that. And we'll talk about it a little bit later. So for any of you guys who actually work night shifts and don't want to run into some of these problems, there is ways around it. Oops, missed one. Oh, there's one I forgot to put on here, but my apologies. But like when you look at all these different factors that seem to play a role in your ability to be able to flip fuel sources and things that tend to bother you or affect your health, I'm sure a lot of you guys have done this in your own job. When you're trying to figure out a particular problem, you've got patches of everything, but you can't quite place it all together. And one study I found on this basically put like all the different dysregulations that we find within the body, the immune system, inflammation, oxidative stress, all these things you guys hear of that make us sick, they all have a central component within your mitochondria. So they all affect energy production. And it seems that at the center of the majority of disease, especially diseases of Western civilization, the mitochondria seems to play a big role. So if we can create better efficiency and we can create healthier, more robust human beings, we'll live longer and live an awful lot happier. Now, what can we do with lifestyle considerations to affect this? Dietary, right? Let's start from easiest to hardest, all right? Caloric restriction, you look at any study on metabolic flexibility, lowering the amount of food you eat will affect metabolic flexibility. So if you're metabolically inflexible, you can't sleep, you can't control your blood sugar, you have all these problems throughout the day of ups and downs of mood and energy, caloric restriction can be effective. Reduce the amount of food you eat, right? Mediterranean diet's shown to be really effective. It tends to be its anti-inflammatory properties. A lot of fish, a lot of olive oil, avocado oil, these kind of things are really anti-inflammatory and they can be really beneficial. Lowering your carbohydrate intake can be beneficial for a lot of people because it allows the adaptation to occur quicker. It almost forces you to start using fat for fuel because you don't have much carbohydrates available. And then when you get to the more extreme end of things, when you've got people with chronic pain, ME/CFS is chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, these slightly more extreme problems. When you have people with brain injuries, so who had traumatic brain injuries at some stage in their lives, the ketogenic diet works really well at lowering that inflammation and improving your ability to be able to use fat for fuel. All right, but it depends where you are on this. Like the majority of you probably need some sort of caloric restriction, little bit of anti-inflammatory use with oils and the types of food we eat, the removal of the crap that we tend to eat, and possibly a lower carbohydrate diet. It is shown to be really beneficial. Do the same things as close to optimal as you can. The body wants structure as much as it can get it. So it's like eating at the same time every day, going to bed and waking up at the same time, training at the same time if you can. And last meal, try not to eat. It's easier now, summertime, right? It's bright till later in the evening. Eat in biological daytime as much as you can. And that doesn't mean that like when it gets dark at 5 o'clock, that you're speeding home and trying to eat in the car as the sun comes down. That's not the goal, right? But as much as you can, stick to as much schedule as you can. And if anybody on here works night shifts, the main aim would be to fast in the evening while you're awake, and try as much as possible to keep your eating schedule in the daytime. It makes a massive difference in your ability to be able to control blood sugar and all the other stuff that we spoke about before. If you have digestive problems, removal of the triggers is a big one. So gluten, dairy, lectins, nightshades, whatever it is for you. For like majority of people who come in and they start working with me, if there's a digestive problem that they're dealing with, it's like normally an elimination diet works really well. So the removal of a lot of the stuff, removal of junk food, gluten, dairy, and then sometimes FODMAPs, there are types of fermentable carbohydrates, can be really, really beneficial. But you'll get the feedback really quickly from these types of diets. So like you don't have to wait months to figure out if they're working. Normally you'll see progress if it's the right one within a week. And you start to see benefits. Particular types of diets, lower carb, paleo, autoimmune paleo, low FODMAP, they're just different extremes of diets. And then when we look at supplements for the immune system, like this is a lot of the stuff that like guys will be telling you to take as kind of like baseline supplements. So vitamin A, D, C, and zinc, like really, really important vitamins for your immune system. Vitamin D, I would say probably, and zinc is the most important ones. And then if you have digestive issues, the use of like glutamine and colostrum can be really beneficial. Prioritize, like especially for like, for the immune system or for gut issues, sleep and stress are massive. When we look at dysbiosis or when we look at gastrointestinal issues, so people who have IBS, for example, those who sleep less have worse symptoms. Those with more stress have worse symptoms, and they both kind of lead into each other. The less you sleep, the more you respond to stress. The better you sleep, the more stress resilient you are. So take these things into consideration. You don't have to jump to super extreme diets like the autoimmune paleo, where you basically have to remove the vast majority of everything. But think like lower carb and paleo. These are really, really effective. I should say FODMAP, not FODMAP. Now, what can you guys do training-wise? This is probably, as any of you guys have been on my calls before, I tend to chirp on about nutrition all the time. As you go through the research on this, this is the one of the major things that you cannot avoid. You cannot get out of this kind of problem without some sort of training. And I was almost disappointed to see that, but it is really, really important. There is metrics you can use. So like we talk about this all the time, like your coach might be telling you to track certain things, or they're asking you what your blood pressure is, what your fasting glucose is, heart rate variability, resting heart rate. All these things are relatively easy to track. Glucose can be a little bit more of a pain, right? But blood pressure, you should know. Heart rate variability is always great to have. And resting heart rate, like resting heart rate and blood pressure are something that we all should know. Heart rate variability is a sign of what's called like parasympathetic tone. So it kind of shows how stressed you are. And what it actually is, you should have inconsistent time between each beat of your heart. So when the heartbeat becomes really consistent, it means that you're stressed normally. And it can be a really good sign of overtraining, overworking, under recovering, under sleeping. And they're really good markers to have. And there are other ways that you can track progress. If your goal is fat loss, that's great. We'll target fat loss. But throughout that process, you can see loads of other things that you can see improvements in. If possibly, which happens sometimes, fat loss stalls, muscle growth stalls, whatever your progress, your objective goal is, these are all objective things that we can track. And they're really, really effective and easy things to track. So when you look at like what's probably metabolic inflexibility, you're probably thinking resting heart rate first thing in the morning, not throughout the day, of 65 plus is normally a sign of a slightly elevated resting heart rate. Mm-hmm. HRV below 60, heart rate recovery is an interesting one. So if you do a bit, like if you do like anaerobic work, so you do a lot of output, like you go really fast for 30 seconds on a bike, it's how quick your heart rate can drop and get back to normal range. So if you're checking your heart rate a minute after you get off the bike and it hasn't dropped at least 20 beats, it's normally not a good sign. All right, this should happen quicker. And blood pressure, 115 over 80, 120 over 80 is normally a really good blood pressure marker. As it starts to creep above that, that's where things tend to go wrong. All right. And then fasting glucose, somewhere between 4.8 and 5, or like for the Americans on the call, somewhere between 80 and 90 will be probably where you want to be in terms of fasting glucose. That's without being fed, right? Now, won't go into this in too much detail for you guys, but when we look at the training side of things, right, everyone always hears about insulin. We need to be insulin sensitive. Insulin gets glucose into the cell to be used. There's another way that that glucose can get into a cell. So it's called non-insulin mediated glucose uptake, blah, 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 right? But basically what that means is if you create contraction in your muscles and you do work, it stops the metabolic gridlock that we spoke about earlier. So where there's too much in the cell, it burns through that and it creates what's called a metabolic emergency. And all that sounds really bad. It's a really important point to get to so that the cell starts to take in glucose again and starts to use it for fuel effectively. So we'll discuss what you can do. And like on this one, I'm just going to discuss the aerobic training side of things because I know it's the one that everyone hates doing, but you can start to see all the things it does to improve all the markers that we just spoke about. So it improves resting heart rate, improves aerobic capacity, heart rate recovery, heart rate variability, parasympathetic tone, blood pressure, and non-insulin mediated glucose uptake. Does it all. So when your coach is telling you to sit on a bike for an hour, there's a reason behind it because it sets the base for you to be able to go and do proper work. If these things aren't in good ranges, you can't out-squat a lot of these problems. You can't out-bench press a lot of these problems, okay? You need to build that base of aerobic power, not aerobic power, of aerobic conditioning so that you can go and do the really hard work. And like it works at a particular intensity. Don't worry about all this, but it works at a particular intensity. So like you can see, at certain parts of VO2 max is like your max ability to be able to work, right? And that uses all glucose. And then somewhere in the middle is that lovely sweet spot. So this is why I like people to track their heart rate, okay? But if you're not in a place to track your heart rate, then a good way to judge if you're working aerobically, you've all seen that guy in the gym at certain stages who's on a bike, he's like, I'm doing my cardio. And he must be pedaling 2 miles an hour. And you're thinking that's not work. That's like getting your steps in, which is important, but it's not aerobic work. When you're doing aerobic work, if you're not tracking your heart rate, if you are, it's somewhere between 120 and 150 beats per minute. It's normally a good marker of aerobic work, right? But if you're not, you should be sweaty. You should be relatively out of breath, but you should be able to hold a conversation. That's normally a sign you're working hard enough. If you're sat there and you're not sweating and you're not panting a little bit, it's a problem. You're not working hard enough to be able to get those benefits to push metabolic flexibility. So this is why a lot of the times, like I'm not going to get into the resistance training part of things now, but it's why, like, so there's some new guys on here that I've been working with. So Lewis is on, George is on. I know Jeff's on. Jeff's kind of transitioned away from this now. But front load conditioning, back load resistance. So what that means is if you get the conditioning and the aerobic work done first, later down the line, you don't have to do it much, okay? Because that aerobic base doesn't disappear. Like strength and power disappears quickly. Aerobic capacity hangs around for a long time. And you probably have to do a little bit then just to keep up with it. So that's why we put this kind of stuff in for you guys. So there is method behind the madness. It's not just that we enjoy putting you on a bike and making you cycle for an hour. All right. So like that's kind of like, you know, steady state like nasal only breathing 3 times a week if you can. You can do 7 days if you want to, but like the more you do with aerobic work, it's a volume game. So the more you do, the better. Okay. So when we think about all this in conclusion, it's like it comes back a lot of the time to the basics. Like you need to clean up your diet, possibly need to remove some carbohydrates from it, supplement with stuff that helps with your immune system, control your stress, fix if you've got a gut problem, try and fix it, and sleep and eat at regular times and do aerobic work. And you'll create this metabolic flexibility, which will lead you for like VO2 max and aerobic capacity are two of the best markers of longevity that you're going to find. VO2 max is actually the most important, and aerobic work will help increase that. It was a quick one this week, so it didn't last nearly as long as last time. Personally, I hibernate. Nice. Has anybody got any questions on any of that? Look, Jeff getting his steps in. What a man.
I got a question. I know one of the slides you mentioned about zinc and that stuff. And I know that recently I have a neuropsychologist, and she mentioned that because I think of ADHD that I should not take it if I don't need it. And that's
mm-hmm. So with, you know, in terms of like a psychological issue, I'm not sure the mechanism behind that. So I won't be able to answer it in too much detail. But if you see people, you can normally spot someone not directly through visually, but like on a blood test, you can tell if someone's zinc deficient, right? But the one thing that zinc will do over time is if you take it just by itself for long periods, it will deplete copper. So that can be one of the issues that you will see with overuse of zinc for long periods of time in people, because they compete for the same transport system. So I have your blood tests. I can check and see if you're low in zinc. I can't remember whether you were, because it's been a while ago. Okay. George?
Hello, Greg. How are you?
Good, brother.
Thank you very much for the presentation. It was great to see all that stuff. It's good to see what we're doing you already have it all down as a professional down pat. I have a quick question. So I did my workout. I'm getting ready for my dinner now. And I have salmon prepared, but I'm not that hungry. So could I supplement? I'm glad I have you here because I'm going to send you a note. Could I supplement with a protein powder? Do 50 grams of protein, get me through the night, or should I don't do that and stick, get some salmon, some vegetables in me? Like, could I do like a protein drink with a green drink afterwards in a little while, something? Or, I don't know. I'm just wondering, like, should I stay light or is that, I don't know. You know, just a quick question.
So, and that's actually always a really good question that that I'm sure coaches tend to get asked, like, do you have to hit your macros? I normally would say, like, if you're not hungry, that's fine. Don't eat a lot of the time, not all the time. You can use a protein shake to hit your macros, because on the diet that you're on at the moment, like, because it's relatively low calorie, like, your hunger will come soon. So, like, there'll come a stage in 2-3 weeks where you'll be praying for dinner to arrive. So at the moment, I'm not too worried about that. I like to let people kind of ride that kind of phase of dieting where they actually, like, they change their diet. They feel really good. There's no hunger. Just enjoy it for now.
All right. Thank you very much, Greg. Thank you.
That's all right. That's actually, Chris put in a good one. VO2 max score. I'd have to get the scores up. Do you remember, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think in this group here, if you're in the high 30s, you're good. You're averagely healthy. You're not athlete. Athletes are going to be 50 plus. You know, extreme athletes are going to be 60 plus. But I would think for our guys to be in the high 30s is something to strive for, or you could even say a number like 40. I just don't know how that would carry over with what you talked about metabolic flexibility. It'd be interesting to see if there is a correlation between the two.
So, like, one, like, important factor. So, like, you always have remember doing it in school at one stage or whatever courses that we did, like aerobic work kind of pushes that stage a little bit further. So like if you're really efficient aerobically, you know, like the onset of blood lactate accumulation or lactate threshold. So like that stage in like where you start to do work and eventually lactate starts to accumulate, aerobic work pushes that further along the scale. So it allows you to work at higher intensities without actually using lactate. So I presume creating, now postulating a little bit, I'm thinking that creating an aerobic base would create a much better VO2 max, guessing a little bit, Chris.
Yeah, when you look at the highest VO2 max scores ever, they were Nordic skiers. And so they're doing some crazy high intense endurance. But if you don't have that aerobic base, like you don't even go to tryouts, let alone make the team.
That's really interesting, actually. Does anyone else know their VO2 max on the call? No, I did mine recently. It turns out I'm just batting average. Very disappointing. I'd almost like to be bad at it rather than average. Has anyone else got any questions?
I have a question, Greg.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I appreciate your wisdom and knowledge here. How do we get our VO2 measured? Is that something we can do on a regular basis?
A VO2 max? Yeah, you can. So there's a couple of different ways you can do it. You can do it. You can do it on a bike or you can do it on a rower. The equation I don't have straight off the top of my head. So when you do it on a bike, I can follow up with you because I know Gav knows it quite well. If you do it on a bike, you need a heart strap. You need a heart rate monitor. So basically what you do is you get on a bike and you just go as fast as you can for 12 minutes. It's very pukey. It's very unpleasant. Or there's an equation that you can do on a rower where you do 2,000 meters as fast as you can.
I just put it in the chat.
Oh, nice. Thank you, Chris.
It's a 2,000 meter row, and you have to put it in your body weight as well. So based on your body weight in pounds or kilos, you do 2,000 meters, and they'll give you your score. It's pretty accurate because the row is like resistance cardio. So it does take in the consideration of a lighter body weight individual versus a heavy body weight individual. So if you're heavier and you get a high, you know, you do it in 7 minutes compared to a lightweight person who does it in 8 minutes, they do have the formula in there to calculate the difference based on resistance. So yeah, there it is there. Click it, fill it out, and then you get your score. Maybe not a bad idea if for fun, everyone does it before the next time Greg runs a call.
It sucks. It does. But it's funny, like when you look at like markers of longevity, like geroscience and or the study of longevity is starting to come on quite a bit. And they're trying to find different markers for like on blood tests. They're trying to find different markers of nutritional status. But still, the most compounding evidence is those who have the highest VO2 max and those who have the best grip strength tend to live the longest. So it's a combination of VO2 max and how strong you are. So all the fancy stuff they're trying to do with science, and they're still the best markers we have. Anybody else? No? Well, I'm more than happy if any of you guys want. Go ahead, Chris.
Greg, I thought it was a good question that was brought up there, and someone said, I'm not hungry, I'm supposed to eat, should I eat? Let's say a client has a goal of fat loss, and then another client has a goal of muscle gain. How would they differ in that situation? It's the end of the day, they're not hungry. Is it okay for someone who's aiming for fat loss to skip a meal? Could that be have a negative effect? And then for someone who's trying to put on muscle mass, should they skip a meal if they're not hungry at the end of the day? I don't mean nighttime, it's like their last meal of the day.
Yeah, that is a good question. Like normally, like you said, with fat loss people, I'd normally let them. Like if they're really not hungry, I'd let them. As long as like for that day, protein wasn't excessively low, I'd probably let them skip it. In terms of like muscle gain, because like the body work, especially with muscle gain, the body works really well on averages. So like it's consistency, consistently eating in a caloric surplus. Like when you're trying to put on muscle, sometimes you just have to suck it up. And anybody who's ever done a phase where they're trying to put on significant amount of muscle in time, you begin to resent the sight of food. And that's just a little bit part of it, unfortunately. And that's why you find a lot of people don't successfully put on muscle, or at least a lot of muscle, is because they can't live like that for extended periods of time.
I did a gaining protocol. So for everyone here who doesn't know, I compete in weight class sports. I've competed in 6 different weight classes. So I've been like super little guy and I've been like heavy fudge. And when I was trying to get to the heaviest set of that I could do, I had to actually start getting up earlier because it took me longer to eat my breakfast. So I had to carve out like a good 45 minutes, you know, per meal each day. And it was just, it sucked. It works. Like it works because you're always in that surplus. Your body's always thinking growth, growth, growth. But, you know, you just got to give up some other things in your life. And mine was a little bit of sleep and lunches and everything. Just had to add time in there just to eat. Not fun. Fat loss, where it's at, just skip that meal. You just save 45 minutes.
People are always waiting though, right? People are like, I can't wait to start bulking. And you're like, it's not as fun as you think, man. Look at Johnny. Johnny's there. He's like, no, it's not necessarily much more fun.
No, I'm on the same page. Chris, exactly what Chris said is perfectly right. It's for a guy like myself, who's not naturally a person that puts on weight easily. I mean, I started at 145 pounds. And so for me to hold 235, 240 is just still a ton of work. I mean, I can balance it out, but I went through many years of really trying to grow and just having to sneak meals into my college classes and sit at the back of the room. And people always used to think I was eating a burrito, but it was a chicken breast wrapped in, you know, like aluminum foil. And I'm sitting there and they're like, you eat a lot of burritos, dude. I'm like, no, it's just a chicken breast. So it's just kind of hiding your food, finding a time to get it in. But yes, it is incredibly annoyingly difficult. So bulking, no fun. But it's, yeah, like Chris said, it's the caloric surplus. So.
Did you just say you put on 100 pounds?
About 90 since I started, but that's like 20 years. So, you
know. Yeah, I suppose, yeah, fair point. Fair point, well taken.
I had the craziest growth from age 12 to 20. It was wild. Just, I don't know what it was. That 8 years was magical.
If anybody has any questions in terms of like any other factors with training, nutrition, like we're all here to answer your questions. So if there's anything else you guys want to ask, it doesn't have to be anything to do with, what I just spoke about, because you got other coaches on here who can answer other questions as well.
You know what? I was actually having a conversation with Russ today, and we were talking about some of his sleep. He's having disturbed sleep and so forth. Greg, what do you know about when you have that last meal of the day close to sleep? How can that affect your sleep scores if you're using an Oura Ring or just your sleep patterns in general? Could it make you more restless at night? Would it affect staying into deep sleep? Anything like that? Do you know?
Yeah, so there's loads of different things that eating late at night tend to do. So when we sleep, the gut does a very specific thing where it's called, like, it does like peristalsis. So like it clears out your gut in preparation for the next day of feeding. And it doesn't do that very efficiently when we have food within our stomachs. So I know I spoke about like left-hand dominated versus right-hand dominated, right? So like be able to use free fatty acids for fuel. Our body does that really efficiently at night. So when we eat and we go to sleep, we find that we get swings in blood sugar throughout the night. So the vast majority of people who wake up excessively throughout the night, that's not associated with stress, right? Because I know stress is a whole different thing. If you're worried about a work presentation or whatever, something you have the next day, that's different. But like the vast majority of people who wake up a significant amount of times throughout the night wake up because their blood sugar starts to swing. And that tends to be one of the major components for it. So that's why eating close to bed is normally not a good thing. And you can always think like, people who eat late at night is always a good sign, right? You should wake up, like it's always the same, like you should wake up hungry and horny, right? Two things. If you're eating really late at night, I guarantee you wake up in the morning and you either are not hungry or you feel slightly nauseous. So it kind of gets that, like, think about it. So like I'm in the UK, we're 5 hours ahead of you, right? So you think if I, when I'm waking up at 6 a.m., my digestion is on New York time. So it's 5 hours behind because it's been dealing with that food throughout the night that it shouldn't be dealing with. Okay, guys, no one got anything else?
Greg, like a random question just off the side, what role does, by looking at all the measures, where does high intensity, not as I want to do it, like HIIT workouts, does that affect anything more than just the general aerobic kind of things, level two type stuff that we're often given? So, is that a track or?
So it does. Like, don't get me wrong, anaerobic work or higher intensity work is really beneficial. It's just not normally, I would say, the first step to it. So like high intensity work will increase your VO2 max quite well. So like there is definitely a part there. So like it's not to be ignored, but I just normally like to put an aerobic base in first before I start throwing in intervals like that. Because a lot of the time people can't, at the very beginning, they really struggle. They either produce way too much lactate too quickly or they can't clear it efficiently. So that's why they tend to struggle with anaerobic work. Like a good example, if you got someone who's type 2 diabetic and overweight, like they'll produce lactate at rest or they'll produce it walking up a slight incline. So putting someone like that and getting them to do 30 on, 30 off on a bike would ruin them. But for guys, like for guys who are more aerobically efficient, yeah, like anaerobic work's really important.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
No problem, brother. All right, guys. So it looks like you're going to get out of here 10 minutes early, unless anybody else has anything else to ask. It's way past my bedtime. We good? Nice one, guys. Well done.
Great job, Greg. Great job.
I'll speak to you all soon.
Have a great week, guys.
Have a great one, guys. Bye-bye.